Warning, we are a spoilers podcast. At times, we are also an offensive podcast. And we are most certainly a verbally explicit podcast. So if you fear for any of your delicate sensibilities, please back up now before you reach the point of no return. All right, pussies, this is your final warning.
All right, welcome to another episode of Cinematic Anarchy. And joining me today for the third part of our late night triple feature picture show, we have Dan and Brett from Clockout Films.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
And we welcome back Matt and Rachel from the Strange and Beautiful Book Club podcast.
Hello.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking about a favorite film of at least a couple of us, I believe. One of the favorites, anyway. The Phantom of the Paradise. Mm-hmm. And instead of just picking on anybody in particular this time, because I know I've thrown both of you under the bus, Matt and Brett, I'm just going to say, Dan and Brett, sorry, I don't think I threw you under the bus, Matt. Would anybody like to give us a quick synopsis of the film?
Rachel, was this your first time watching it?
It was.
All right. Ditto. I've seen this movie a few times, so I want to hear an outside perspective of a synopsis.
A synopsis? Okay. Isn't it a retelling of Faust where a composer mistakenly believes that his music is going to be used by this famous radio executive named Swan, and instead it's just stolen from him, and so he slowly goes mad and he becomes the phantom of Swan's new Disneyland version of a venue called the Paradise, where he wantonly murders a bunch of people in pursuit of this one woman performing his music, and then ultimately signs a deal with the devil. She signs a deal with the devil, and then everybody dies. Except the woman. Phoenix.
Sounds pretty on point.
That's fairly accurate, yeah.
I thought it was a mix of Phantom of the Opera, Faust, and Dorian Gray.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. With rock music.
Yeah, I would like all opening credit exposition to be done in the form of a 70s rock ballad from now on.
Or the Juicy Fruits, which is like basically a play on Sha-na-na from the 70s.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I guess
that opening song, I didn't know what this movie was going to be like. Am I going to be able to endure this movie? But thankfully, it got better.
I was trying to figure out why the lead singer of the Juicy Fruits, when he's singing, it was interesting. Like, he broke into sort of a speaking part in the middle of the song and immediately adopted a very thin Latino accent.
I mean, I guess because that was a play on a lot of doo-wop songs from back in the day, like the, you know, when they would when the bridge would come along, and then they would just do a spoken word of the bridge.
I mean, did you have a lot of white guys suddenly just breaking into sort of an Edward James Olmos accent?
I haven't heard of them ever doing a Latino accent in the middle of the song, but
I mean, I guess somebody has to be a trailblazer, right?
Even going back to Richie Valens, I don't think he ever went into full Latino in the middle of a bridge, especially during Madonna.
It's a 70s movie, so I'm pretty sure it's like the Wild Wild West. You just do what you want. That's what he did, and they were like, cut, done. Yeah.
All right, so our film basically opens, like you were saying, with the Juicy Fruits singing the opening song. Is it Goodbye, Eddie, Goodbye, or something to that nature?
Something like that.
Yeah.
The whole thing where he basically has a little bit of a mock suicide fit on the stage. Closing out the song.
Oh, yeah, that aged great.
Oh, yeah.
Where he, like, pretends to shoot himself in the arm, and then he slices himself with a knife.
A little bit of harikari, just with a switchblade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, it's the 70s. All right, that's fine.
I think the idea behind the song was
completely 70s. It's, like, utterly 70s that it hurts.
Yeah.
I think the idea behind the song is that he's trying to afford a surgery for, was it his sister? The idea behind the song is he killed himself basically to provide the life insurance policy to the person that he was trying to afford the surgery to. I wasn't quite sure if it was a girlfriend or a wife or sister, or I don't think I paid that close attention to the opening song.
Was this an existing song, or was this an original composition for the movie?
All this music was
It's all original compositions by
Paul Williams.
Swan himself wrote all the music, Paul Williams.
All right.
So he actually was nominated for
be thematically into the rest of the movie, or?
Oh, wow. I did not know he was nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah, he was nominated for Academy Award for Best Soundtrack, and then I think after this he went on to write Rainbow Connection for The Muppets, and then I think he actually did win the Oscar for that year.
That would explain his guesting performances on The Muppet Show. I think he was on there more than a few times.
And then he actually went on to voice the Penguin in Batman the Animated Series.
No, I did not know. That I did not
know. He gets around.
That's quite the career.
He's had quite a hefty career, Paul Williams.
Well, he's definitely...
I think he makes the movie for me.
Yeah.
I think he steals the show in every scene he's in.
I could have dealt with a little bit more of Garrett Graham, personally.
Oh, well, Garrett Graham is amazing. Like, the first movie I saw Garrett Graham in was Chud 2.
Oh, God. Bud the Chud?
Yep, Bud the Chud.
Bud the Chud.
When recently getting into Tales from the Crypt, I realized that he's in the first Tales from the Crypt episode. He's one of the first victims in Tales from the Crypt.
Oh, wow.
Time to go back over Tales of the Crypt, I guess.
I was like, hey, that's beef.
I think William Finley's performance as Winslow really kind of made me want to go back and see if I could find some more performances with him in it.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's one in particular that I sent a link out. I don't know if I sent it to you guys. I know I sent it out to Piper, but there's an old movie with John Candy and Anthony Hopkins that seemed kind of interesting.
Quite a mix.
I don't think it was well known for the Anthony Hopkins. And I'm saying Anthony Hopkins. It's not Hopkins. It's Perkins.
Oh, Anthony Psycho. Perkins. Even so, that's still quite a mix. We got Uncle Buck and Norman Bates.
I mean, take those two characters. I'll watch whatever you got.
Same.
And now I can't find the name of the damn movie. That's just like me. I bring something up, I can't find it.
Now I gotta look. Oh wait, I can look it up because I'm watching on my phone right now.
Right,
I can probably look it up.
I'm gonna be digging
around.
Rod
Sterling reads that opening. The opening at the very beginning, where we talk about Swan.
On my copy,
really? Rod Sterling.
Mm-hmm. That's Rod Sterling.
On my copy of the film,
sound is familiar.
It was played so low, I had to turn it up, and then it immediately goes into that opening song, was just blasted through the house.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So that was
we thought the sound wasn't working because the subtitles were working during that intro monologue, and we thought the sound wasn't working, so we turned the sound way up, and then the music kicked in, and we had to.
It was horrendous.
Now, am I the only one that kind of looks at this movie as kind of a superhero movie?
I think so.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, they wanted to call it The Phantom.
Maybe it's because, like, I know Paul Williams as playing the Penguin. So, like, for some reason, I feel like he's a great villain and the Phantom is a masked vigilante hero. That's how I look at the movie.
Feels a little like
But instead of trying to avenge crime, he's trying to avenge like corporate corruption.
Toxic Avenger.
I think it was so close to Phantom of the Opera that it was like modern 70s rock Phantom of the Opera.
Like the Toxic
and then
Avenger
there's
well before
with the
Toxic
guys
Avenger.
In the black and white makeup, and I'm convinced that the guy with the big black curly hair is Gene Simmons.
Guest star.
I couldn't find him in the cast list, but I was fairly convinced the guy that they pierced his torso near the end of the film was Rip Torn.
Really? I mean, the name's fitting for an early role.
Yeah.
I said Rip Torn. It's Rip Taylor is what I was thinking. The
Rip
comedian.
Taylor.
The comedian.
Oh, well, Rip
yeah,
Torn also.
The very flamboyant comedian that throws glitter in the air everywhere he goes. That's who I thought that was. A very loud shirt. The face and the hair looked spot on for that, and I could be
I
absolutely
wrong.
I just know
him as the voice of the genie from the DuckTales movie.
The classics. Just referencing the classics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know, I checked out a little bit at the end, like I was there, but I had been reading the trivia, and I gather this is also Daft Punk's, one of Daft Punk's, like, favorite movies. Like, this was what they referenced as their stylistic, like, inspiration.
I can so see I was that waiting for us. The helmets and everything, so.
Yeah.
No, yeah, in the synthesizer room.
Yeah, I was waiting for them to use, they're sitting in that custom-built Moog. That's what he's sitting in when he's playing on the piano. And I'm like, okay, cool, we're going to get synthesizer music, and... Oh, alas, we got no synthesizer.
Yeah, I held out for like the second half of the movie after Rachel mentioned that, looking for, okay, what did Daft Punk see in this movie to inspire them? Maybe I can see it too, and I didn't really see it.
Yeah.
Were you not a fan of the movie, Matt?
I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it by the end. It was probably the first half of the movie. I was in it just because we were supposed to watch it.
Well, the slow descent is hard to watch, where he goes from being like a composer who's just trying to get his name out there to like getting imprisoned and having his teeth ripped out and then like escaping.
Yeah, that escalated pretty quickly.
He was having his face lifted by a vinyl press.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
By a vinyl pressing of his own album, by the way. The music for his own album. And all of that that teeth pulling was sponsored by Swan and his label.
Yes, his experimental dental program at the prison.
Yeah.
All right, now I have a hot take. I think this is a better cult classic musical than Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I'm going to have to agree with you.
I mean, I like...
Not to fault Rocky Horror Picture Show for anything, but I think this is a tighter movie.
Yeah. In terms of just, like, narratively, yeah. I would agree with
Rocky
that.
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, I'd say there's a lot more plot
I love it
here.
But I feel like it just kind of is... It's kind of a jumbled mess as a movie, and narratively. Because you have no idea where it's going until it ends.
I mean, I think
guess that kind of like goes with the anarchy of it, but...
The star power is what gives it its longevity. There isn't as much...
Tim Curry's performance is just the, you know, timeless.
Because you're not really hearing a lot from the cast of The Phantom of the Paradise right this minute, outside of maybe Paul Williams.
Well, did you guys know there is actually a connection between Rocky Horror and Phantom of the Paradise through actress Jessica Harper?
Huh.
Yeah. She was
I knew you were going to bring up the Jessica Harper trivia.
Yeah,
being the Suspiria fan you are. Go ahead.
Yes, Suspiria as well. But Shock Treatment, which was the sequel to Rocky Horror. And she plays Janet, another version.
You're using that word sequel very loosely. Very loosely.
Very.
Inspired by.
Yes.
I guess this movie was super popular specifically in Winnipeg.
In Manitoba.
Like, it was in the theater for months and months, and they're having a 50th anniversary celebration this year. That's because it was so popular there.
I wonder what they do for, you know how Rocky Horror has those fun screenings, and you throw things at the screen, and what do you do for a Phantom of the Paradise? Do you throw pens at the screen, bloody pens at the screen? Do you throw vinyl?
Hopefully not electrocute anybody on stage. I like that scene where he gets electrocuted, the like stop motion thing they did. That was really cool.
Yeah, the visual effect is nice.
Apparently, you might want to burn reel-to-reel video.
Oh, yeah, you throw reels at the screen. There you go.
Like it's streamers, you know? Just reels of film.
I think the scene where he walks into the mansion and all the women are like practicing singing is probably the creepiest part in the movie, because at first you don't know that that's what it is, so it just sounds really unearthly when he walks in. And I hate that we bookmarked that with, like, sexual assault at the end of it. Which was so 70s.
When they're all on the stairs waiting to go in for the
audition. Yeah.
Eyes shut. I don't know, but I thought it was, like, kind of very sweet that he makes that connection with Phoenix. And he's
going
along with her.
Yeah, it's just they go through the door and then they get, like, pinned down on the couch.
Yeah, that's what's happening through the door.
That was a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's supposed to be disturbing because it's supposed to show Swan's like sleaziness.
You don't get to feel the sweetness of that connection because immediately you have Laszlo getting thrown out on his ass and her getting sexually assaulted upstairs. So,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we have sex pillows between there.
Music, essentially.
Yeah. And all of his doors are really short. He's really short.
That's so funny. Paul Williams is what, 5 foot
five
two,
foot
you
two,
said?
Yeah.
So all the doors are just the right height for him. And so all the other guys have to duck through every single door in his building.
That's a really good observation. I didn't even notice that until you pointed that out.
Kind of reminds me of that. That, what is it, floor 13 and a half and being John, I was gonna say John Lovitz, John Malkovich. That half floor where everybody has to duck to be able to get through the building. I was going to say being John Lovitz, but that would have been a very, very different movie.
Yeah. I like when he goes to see the secretary and she looks for his name and it's like Bette Midler. There's like all these really famous 70s artists.
Mm.
Flips it up. Never
yeah,
to
Laszlo,
be seen.
Never to be seen. Get him out of here. Very innocent through the entire thing. Just I was told that he wanted to produce my cantata and he never called me back. It's been months. It's like, oh, you don't realize he's stolen your work at this point? Very naive, but okay.
Yeah. Well, a little bit. But that's, I mean, it gets him, pushes him through the scenario.
Suffering.
Yeah. The suffering. Yeah. So that he loses his voice at some point. I don't know why.
He has to get it
back with a synthesizer.
I think he lost his voice in the process of getting his face pressed by the record machine there.
Oh, yeah, it could be. Which I guess the actor, they used a real record press for that.
The machine.
Was like, is it going to be okay? And they're like, yeah, fine. Because they put chocks in between it to keep it from shutting. And it was so powerful, it actually broke the chocks. And he had to pull his head out before it got crushed.
Oh,
my God.
So that's him being like, oh, God, like his, I guess they said his scream.
They replaced
whatever,
the pressing block with foam, but it was not super squishy foam, so his head was still going to get squished.
Yeah.
That's so a little bit of
screams, OSHA approved. It's his real scream, just
OSHA,
trying to yank his head up.
OSHA approved.
wait a minute, didn't he get shot in the throat by the cop when he was trying to escape, and that's what happened?
They found him beaten up, and that's when they put something in his purse.
Oh, yeah, they planted the drugs on him.
Yeah.
No, I mean when he was escaping. He escapes from Sing Sing.
So
maybe
breaks into the record label.
He hears that Swan is producing his music. It's on the radio, and he jumps the guard and runs for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And leaves in the most unconventional way. Like, first of all, any of the guards in that building, if they let him escape in that box after watching him go down the conveyor belt, I'm thinking they should lose their job.
It's fine.
Whatever training
really
you were given,
guard,
sucks.
Like that's all it took for him to escape was just like that one guard by the conveyor belt.
Were they like putting together boxes of tiddlywinks?
Yeah.
Something like that. Game, it was like
board games.
Game.
Yeah. So and he's got a hat on that's like Swan Industries.
Rather than the standard visual of people pressing license plate, they're putting together board games for children.
Yeah.
Yeah. But nowadays, most things that say "Made in America" are assembled by prisoners. Because they only have to pay him like 75 cents an hour.
Oh.
Wow.
Mm.
And now you know.
Made in America, paying for the cigarettes in prison. Sounds good. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Did you notice they had to go back and put that dead bird logo in a whole bunch of places?
It was everywhere.
Yeah. They had used a copyrighted name. They'd used like Swan Song, like Swan Song Records. And I gather that's like Led Zeppelin's record, maybe. And they had, so they were going to get sued.
Yeah,
they had to go back in
big rock band.
And put the little dead bird. So that's why sometimes it looks like it's added in post, because it is.
Interesting.
So it's added in post, definitely because it is. To avoid lawsuits.
Yeah. Because they almost got sued because they were going to call it the Phantom. Stop. The Phantom. But the Phantom is a superhero, a la Billy Zane in the purple suit.
Yeah.
From the 90s.
From Africa. Billy Zane from Africa.
The African superhero
Zane. That would have been way, way before Billy Zane and his acting career, though. The Phantom would have been just a comic strip back
then. I mean,
the
Phantom
then.
Was still like a comic strip, yeah.
Going back to Tales from the Crypt, that's how he got pretty much his start.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, Demon Knight.
Demon Knight, and going back to the early episodes, he was in... Oh, what the hell is that episode called? It was about a magician. That's one of his earlier roles.
I've forgotten more about Tales from the Crypt than I realized.
I went into a binge when I got like the whole DVD set. So,
I mean, to be fair, I haven't watched Tales from the Crypt since it was, like, originally aired on television, so... So, yeah, I mean, well, I've forgotten quite a bit about it.
I highly recommend investing in one of the Blu-ray or DVD sets.
And just the full set.
In a little binge.
Now, I'd rather get the VHS box set.
The VHS box? You'll be there for days.
So big. Just, like, all of them.
Speaking of the connection between the two films, Jessica Harper, did you prefer her musical performance here or in Shock Treatment? Like, her singing?
Ooh. I would go here in this one.
Okay. Anyone else? Has anybody else seen both of them?
I would go here. I mean, I agreed with Winslow that she was, like, a good voice for his music.
I think I definitely...
It was the most, like, 70s voice. The, like, deep female voice. It was a very...
She's got that Carpenter-esque voice to her.
It was really off-putting in Shock Treatment, as far as I was concerned. Jessica Harper, her voice, like, I'm not saying her singing is bad by any stretch of the imagination, but in contrast to the other people singing throughout that particular movie, her voice just hits you like a velvet sledgehammer. Like, oh, no.
I've seen Rocky Horror a million times, but I've actually never seen Shock Treatment, so that question tripped me up.
You're not missing much. You're not missing much at all.
I guess I'm shocked you haven't seen it.
No.
You might want to treat yourself to that.
Oh.
Treatment yourself. No, it doesn't really work. Okay.
I see what you did there.
Harper in it, so.
Favorite scene.
Favorite scene here in this film?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, let's get out of Shock Treatment because we've already done that one.
I'm going to go Sex Pillow. Yeah.
The sex pillow scene.
For all the way.
Very thinly veiled Laszlo.
You're like, he's watching. So creepy.
Oh, they went from
and
being.
Then Winslow's on the pillow underneath all of them.
They went from being sexually assaulted to very accepting of the whole situation real quick, didn't they?
Yeah. The one lady's like, I've been here 15 times.
And I still don't sing for him.
Get that F out of here.
Haven't sung yet.
And then Swan comes out and they're like, Swan! Swan! That was the best part. Because, like, he's this 5 foot, not that short, guys are unattractive, but he's like this 5 foot two. Like, he's Paul Williams.
I love
and
that's like, the way they build him up.
Yeah. And he just, like, lays down in the middle of them and they all pile on. That was my favorite part.
It was so weird. Like, because Brian De Palma 70s. Is always known for, like, more serious movies, but yet this one has, like, that light, like, comic flair to it.
Like, none of the women in the room knew that Laszlo was Laszlo at all. Like, it's not like he put on makeup or put on a wig or did anything other than throw a muumuu on. Okay.
I mean, yeah, I want to see how like did a, he sneak himself in there
with all types of women, so he could have been anybody, you know.
Yeah. That leads me to believe that the women were on just a few pills here or there. They were not in their right minds.
I did like that part where he goes, breakfast, and he opens the suitcase and it's nothing but pill containers.
Actually, those are my favorite scenes where it's Winslow and Swan talking in like the hidden room.
Yeah.
I just feel like those two actors just work so well together.
I think the lead up to Laszlo's first assault... Basically, that whole lead up to where he places the bomb in the back of the car while they're singing the song Carburetors.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That,
the one guy trying to escape, he goes, I gotta go, man. Something doesn't feel right. What are you? What sign are you? You're Leo? Okay, you're fine, but I need to leave. I'm out of here.
And he just gives him pills.
Here, just he's pops like, here. Some pills.
He just shoves pills in his mouth.
You know, he's choking the entire time. He's dragged across the stage on the car. Just at, you can see them trying to sing, and he's definitely trying to hack up the pills he had to swallow dry.
What about
he says
he's trying to follow his gut.
Well, you can hear a ticking sound. He's like, I can hear a ticking sound, man. I don't know.
What about
he's right next to the bomb?
What about Beef's shower scene?
Oh yes, when Laszlo comes in and threatens him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he sticks a plunger over his mouth. That was a good scene. He was a good character. I thought Beef was a really good character.
So anything with Beef in it was fantastic. Like he's just screaming into the microphone while they're trying to set everything up. He's like, the hell with this. I can't write this. This was written for a chick.
Yeah.
I like and all how of his Beast costumes. was actually being smart about it, and he like after the shower scene, he packs his shit up. He's like, I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And of course, the answer to everything is take a pill.
There is a phantom here.
Yeah.
Just take a pill. That'll bring me down, man. No, just take the pill and get back inside. You got a job to do.
I am a professional.
The entire time,
his costumes were great.
The entire time Beef is doing his performance on stage, he's constantly looking over his shoulder, then gets back into the performance and looks over his shoulder again.
That's great subtle acting there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he was good.
Ugh.
Like those pants he wears. At the very beginning, he wears the pants with the like giant acrylic belt buckle that has the snake on it. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's like the first outfit he wears in the Paradise.
The over-the-top glam rock parodies.
Like way over the top.
Oh, it was good. Yeah, he was a good character. I love those 70s. We just finished watching a bunch of 70s movies, and I love those 70s like ambiguously queer-coded characters where they weren't sure if they could come out and say this guy isn't straight but they could make him like flamboyant and over like glitter-haired and like makeup. It's my favorite like sneak 70s thing.
Or the androgyny of the 70s glam rock.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There'd be complaints
about
the movie.
He has a porn magazine on his table when he's like putting his makeup on, and it's like a buff dude. You notice that? It's leaned up against his mirror. Yeah. It's leaned up against his mirror when he's like he's painting his face tattoo on.
I did not see that.
Well, now you will.
Now I'm gonna be looking for it. It's one of those subtle things.
So the scene where Winslow finds the tape, where Swan is talking to his evil self in the mirror. What did everybody think of that scene? I can't praise Paul Williams enough for his performance in this movie, but to act to yourself in the mirror, like I think that rivals Willem Dafoe acting to himself in the mirror in Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, that scene was well done.
Yeah.
I liked how they did the doubled up bathtub.
I would even venture to say Willem Dafoe may have pulled a little from that scene for his performance.
Mm-hmm. He may have, yeah. That duality.
Well, no one can prove us wrong, so.
No, I definitely, I think that Paul Williams is definitely a fantastic fucking actor. I have not seen a lot of his stuff, though, so I may have to go and dig out some
things. No, like, he mostly is kind of, like, just behind the scenes being, like, a songwriting type of dude.
He needs to be on screen more often. He does.
He's still alive.
Yeah, he's, like, and he's still performing. He's, like, I think he's, like, 76-ish.
Okay, that's the only other area I remember seeing.
So he'd be 84? But I think he's born in 1940. He's the same age as all the three main actors. Pretty much are all the same age in this
movie. Wise, the only other thing that
famous song we've only just begun.
Yeah, isn't that the Carpenters?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which we just compared the main actress to.
We did. Oh man, bringing it back.
Movie wise, the only other thing that I remember seeing Paul Williams in just directly are there's like three different. Smokey and the Bandit and the two sequels directly thereafter, 2 and 3. He was in all three of them.
Huh. See, I never saw any of those.
Okie and the Bandit. Me neither.
I've seen them all, but I spent a little too much time in Georgia, so we'll just blame that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's we'll fair. That.
Yeah.
Blaming Georgia is always a...
Blame Georgia for what was essentially a very deep South American action movie.
Now, Chris, was this your first time watching this?
I had watched it a long while ago, back when I had it on VHS. And I've picked it up on Blu-ray and have not had the opportunity to actually watch it. I kept trying to convince my kid to sit down with me and watch it. And he just, yeah, let's do that. And then one thing or another pops up and, nope, okay, well, we'll wait and we'll wait and we'll wait. And then I was like, to hell with it. I'm just going to do an episode. Give myself an excuse to just watch it.
Yeah, now you have to watch it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the podcast has been a great excuse to motivate us to go actually watch something.
Yeah.
And what was your reaction after the blurry VHS watching from years ago?
The VHS that I had a while back was mangled. So it was not a good copy. So you want to say blurry? Yeah, it was one of those things that was constantly trying to find tracking.
I meant blurry as in a blurred memory of it.
Ah, okay. Well, blurred memory, different thing. As you were saying, I have watched Rocky Horror several times recently because my son is just discovering both of those films. He will not watch Shock Treatment again. He's like, I don't know what that was, but we're not putting that on again. I enjoyed the Rocky Horror Picture Show, so I remember kind of enjoying what I watched way back when, and now watching it again, I like this more. I enjoyed this more. I would be willing to watch this more frequently, and I'm surprised, genuinely surprised, that they don't have a lot of stage shows revolving around this.
Me neither. I mean, like I said earlier, you would think that there would be, but like,
it's a little harder to sing along.
You got to find those traditions. You got to put into it to keep people coming.
I think they should start a tradition.
Casts and throwing things at the screen or having the callback lines to it,
like stage shows of this and the Rocky Horror Picture Show back to back.
Actually, the working together will probably be even better.
Which one had less like moments where the music invites you to participate? Like, I feel like Rocky Horror Picture Show has a lot of like, okay, there's the song where we all like, here's how we're going to dance to this song, or the people on the screen are dancing, and this one's a lot of like performers on stage.
You got so it's not there. A lot that's, of that's probably why Rocky Horror like invokes a lot more audience more participatory because of the dance numbers. Like, you know, you got Time Warp, and Time Warp has a whole dance to it and everything.
Yeah.
But when you're a kid, you jump up in front of the screen and you try to mimic the dance in front of the TV.
Yeah. This one is a lot more just performed music, especially at the end where it's like a lot of songs back to back. It kind of felt like a music video for a little while, but a lot of it's just watching people sing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few songs that you could definitely get into the performances, especially with like Beef performing on stage or the Juicy Fruits at the very beginning. I'm not sure. Was that also supposed to be... What group was that supposed to be that was sort of doing the Beach Boys riff in the middle?
It was still the Juicy Fruits, but it was the Juicy Fruits basically in a latter half of their career.
Yeah, they're three different bands. They're like the Juicy Fruits, and then they're another one, and then they're the Undeads at the very end. But it's the same three dudes. Because in the credits it shows you them and it shows you all three band names.
And then in their middle career they turn into like a Brian Wilson Beach Boys thing, and then they turn into like Kiss by the latter half.
Yeah.
Yeah, essentially.
With the black and white. I was like, oh, which one came first? I was gonna look that up. Like,
Kiss led by Graham Garrett.
Black and white makeup first.
Kind of doing something. I was saying Chris led by Graham Garrett, kind of doing something halfway between Gene Simmons and Ziggy Stardust.
I think he was more like he was definitely doing something more like David Johansen, I think.
Oh wow, New York Dolls.
Yes,
I didn't even see now. Yeah, okay, I agree with. It doesn't take me too much to agree with somebody else. Just say something convincing and I'll nod quite a bit. I noticed that...
I like the scene where he had so much glitter in his hair. You can see the glitter like fluff off every time he moves his head.
When he's swinging his guitar around.
He tips his head back and you can see it fall off the back of his head. All the glitter. Because he's got like that glitter wig on.
Does anybody wonder how Jessica Harper always comes off in her movies as somebody that just gets naively dragged into cultish situations?
Everybody needs a niche.
Yeah, everybody needs that typecast, you know.
I mean that was her typecast. You can go with Suspiria, you can go with this film, you can go with Shock Treatment, but it was all kind of the same thing. She was very naive, got dragged into a bad situation, somebody else had to get her out of it.
More or less, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
This one felt more like ambition rather than naivete. Like she was willing to do whatever it took to get what she wanted.
Well, there was a certain amount of naivety in that willingness to just give everything to the devil, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I will do
not
anything.
Understanding what the actual consequences would be.
But she didn't know that Paul Williams was possessed by the devil.
Right.
She was easily influenced.
She threw her morals off real quick, because she was like, she walked into that room, ran right out in the beginning, like, no, I'm not going to do that. And then he asks her once, and she's like, I'll give you anything. everything. It's like, okay, well, that situation earlier, you drew a line in the sand, and now you're like, oh, you know, let me just erase that. See, come here.
Well, the second time, it was actually about her vocal performance.
Mm. And there is that heartbreaking scene where Winslow is watching him, like, get things down through, like, the ceiling through window.
The skylight? Yeah, the
skylight.
Which
all the cameras cracked me up.
Swan has conveniently set up a camera. 70s
cameras.
Oh yeah, the 70s yeah. cameras with the big red light on them, the
blinking light.
So they're like right behind. I was like, "Where's that camera?" Because Swan switches like it on, so you can see him being watched by the Phantom guy. And then you see the camera behind him. It's like 2 feet behind his head, and it's like a giant 70s camera.
Well, I guess he felt like.
I love the line that. Swan delivers in that scene when he meets him up on the ceiling. He's like, if you ever say, well, what you say, boo, it's the way he says boo. It's hilarious.
It's that 70s.
Not like the contract again.
Yeah. It's not like the mid-Atlantic accent from the 50s, but it's that 70s American accent that really, it's hard to describe it. When you hear it, you know it. And that's what he has it. And so you heard it throughout the whole movie.
I mean, transatlantic, you mean,
Yeah, the posh 50s accent.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of liked that speech that he gave, standing over Laszlo, the whole James Bond, I'm going to give away everything on how you're going to be able to kill me right here. He's just standing over him, he's like, oh, I'm under contract too, and he gave away the whole bit, of how to figure out how to kill him. He's like, you can't do anything about it.
Right,
and then he brushes past it to talk about love songs that he wrote.
But that was just more of a reminder to the audience of how the hero can get out of it. So
yeah.
I'm willing to forgive a little bit of a plot hole there.
Yeah, this movie was actually pretty tight for plot holes, considering as wild as they had it going. There was no moment where I was like, wait, hang on, how did he get there? Because every time he would get up in the ceiling, you'd get a cool shot of him getting lifted up into the ceiling or him climbing or whatever, instead of it just being and then he was in the rafters.
Well, I mean, clearly when he was escaping the prison, he flattened that box that he tried to get out of there in. So that was not the
Besides
same
that,
box.
That was fine. It's fine.
Once the box lands, he's like, yeah, he Ace Ventura's out of it.
Minus the rhinoceros.
Yeah, minus.
Yeah. Oh my god! Just watched that movie with my kids.
Oh, is there any scenes within the film that you think could have been done better, or things that you didn't particularly like?
I thought some of the songs were a little long. I mean, they're fine, but some of them went on for the scene where we're assembling beef, where they're cutting people's hands and arms and legs and stuff off. That felt really long.
I'll kind of agree with that. Like I said, that this is a tighter movie than Rocky Horror Picture Show, but I will say that that Rocky Horror does have the slightly better, catchier soundtrack.
I think
some more punch to the songs would be ideal.
Yeah,
I don't think you'd catch me listening to this particular soundtrack in my car going down the street. No, probably not. Some of it's really depressing, actually. Really depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a lot of melancholy to it.
Like that music that you just kind of sit in a room by yourself in the dark and just drink.
Would you listen to, would you rather listen to Winslow Faust or would you rather listen to Time Warp? There you go.
Going with the Time Warp.
Depends on the mood.
As much as I like this movie more than I do Rocky Horror Picture Show, Rocky definitely has the more timeless soundtrack.
That's where the pros and cons are. I feel like this is a tighter movie, whereas Rocky Horror has the better soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a cast that people are familiar with.
Yeah. There's
not a lot of people here, unless you're, into some of the more, obscure stuff from the 70s and 80s. Not so obscure in the case of Jessica Harper, because she's got some, she's probably the most recognizable face in the whole group. Like, my son could pick Jessica Harper out of a lineup. If you ask him who the hell Paul Williams is, he'll be like, what? Who?
No guy. Idea.
That guy over there.
Yeah.
The guy. He's short. That's about all I've got here. Short, slightly British accent, long hair. He once sung alongside of Kermit the Frog, I think.
Mm-hmm. So. And one character wears a mask for half the movie, like a full face mask.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Winslow.
Yeah. I guess I have to watch William Finley's other performances because I really liked him in this film. Like, I feel like he should have been in some other kind of creepy fare.
The way he uses his eye in that mask is so good.
Yeah.
Like he.
Yeah, he had to act through that mask.
Yeah, he wrecked. He wrecked the Phantom role.
What other movies has he been in?
Oh, jeez. That was the thing. I was looking that up earlier. He's been in a lot of sort of obscure films. He was in the more recent film, actually, The Black Dahlia. There's an old film called Sisters that he was in, also starring Jessica Harper.
Huh.
See, now I'm trying to look up some of his other films. I didn't have that sitting right in front of me. he was in a movie called...
There's not a lot I recognize. Mostly in the 70s.
No, I recognize several of the films. Funhouse he was in.
Was he?
Yeah.
By Tobe Hooper?
Yep. Yeah.
That same one?
If I'm not mistaken, yeah. Funhouse. He was Marco the Magnificent.
Is he the one that says, hey, let's spend the night in the funhouse?
Yeah.
is he the guy that comes up with the idea?
I believe so, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, shit.
He also...
I gotta rewatch that. I haven't watched that in years.
Much like some other people from this movie, he was also in Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
It could have just been the 70s. Everyone was in it. Everybody gets to be in it. It's like Outer Limits. Everybody gets to be in it.
So he hasn't been in a lot.
There's so many episodes.
But he's had some decent parts here and there.
He's been in some decent films, and he's been in Masters of Horror, the Masters of Horror TV series, unaccredited husband, I guess. He was a werewolf in Sabrina the Teenage Witch. And he was Dr. Neville in an episode of Tales from the Crypt.
Dr. Neville.
So he's been in quite a few things, it's just...
What's the episode called?
That I do not have. Hold on. I can tell you in just a moment. Okay. Till Death Do We Part. Which is interesting, because that's the scene where Jessica Harper was supposed to bite it at the very end. During that line.
I think I know that episode.
Till Death. Oh, yeah. Boom.
I think it's like a...
Yeah, but instead they kill the... Philbin.
Can you say the synopsis of the episode? I gotta remember if I've seen that one.
Season 5, episode 13, a young gigolo and husband of a female mobster begins an affair with a nightclub waitress, and the two plot to overthrow the gangster. They added an S where it didn't belong.
Okay. So it was one of those romantic thriller episodes.
Yep, starring John Stamos.
Wow.
So Stamos plays the young gigolo and husband.
God, this is a roller coaster.
I could see Stamos as a gigolo, I guess, back in his
that's fine.
Full House days.
Yeah, you can kind of make a connection that the Juicy Fruits are the Beach Boys.
So. Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
There you go.
Very true. Yeah, there's one other scene that I keep going back to. We were talking about favorite scenes earlier, and as much as it's a little sad, Garrett Graham as Beef getting electrocuted by the Phantom. Just the...
That effect was really cool. I was like, oh, that's really neat.
And directly thereafter...
The strobe.
Directly thereafter, Swan's greaser thug, who apparently does not know how to use a fire extinguisher, goes out holding the fire extinguisher in one hand, squeezing the thing, but pointing it directly down. Like, not at the fire, just down.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so you didn't get a bunch of that, the fire extinguisher smoke in front of the camera, but I get it. But
yeah,
you weren't pointing it at the fire. It made no effect whatsoever. You're basically just dousing your feet. Who knows? Well, blue suede shoes might have been on fire. I have no idea.
He's the priest that gets shot at the end anyway.
Deservingly so.
Philbin. Yeah.
Rachel, Matt, I don't think you said yet. What were your favorite scenes?
Well, I said sex pillow, but I don't think Matt said one.
That's right.
I think the descent of Winslow escaping from prison and getting disfigured, and because it really it makes him become that character.
It's a tragic spiral.
Yeah,
yeah.
I like tragic characters. So
most tragic thing that happens in the movie, because he just wants to be a composer. He's
right, I've only written 200 pages. Out. Then he gets wounded in the escape, and then he gets his face pressed with the
stolen
version of his music.
Yeah.
Swan stolen literally imprinted on his face.
So he decides the only option is revenge.
Well, he ends up signing with Swan, who tries to brick him in. That was so
hard. Does brick him in.
So over the top.
Well,
I mean, it's on par.
Did they explain how he escaped from the bricked-in room?
They show, like, crumbled brick on top
he
of
the room. He blasted it through the brick wall and the metal door.
He does the thing where he, like, wakes up and screams, "My music so loud everybody hears it." And apparently that, like, gives him the strength to break the
So
the wall. He gets some, like, superhero vibes a la Darkman.
Yeah.
Where I was thinking
immune to pain.
I was thinking Toxic Avenger.
Which some people can say that's kind of like Sam Raimi's Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's fair.
Halfway between Toxic Avenger and Darkman.
Yeah, there you go.
Retaining more facial features. Has
always had some kind of a tragedy to them.
Retaining more features, facial features than either one of them, though.
Yeah. Like, even RoboCop, he got blown to bits. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very true, but you still had the face.
He still had the face, because that's all he had left.
All you need is Peter Weller's face. You're good. That's all you need. The rest of it's inconsequential.
What was one of your favorite scenes?
What?
What was one of your favorite scenes?
I haven't seen it in a very long time, so I vaguely remember it. But now my brother's calling. Horrible timing. anyway, I guess from what I did, like, a little, like, review right before I watched it, and I do like what you said, Dan, with the whole, like, talking to the devil thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really cool scene. And the climax with the show and the car explosion, all that was cool.
Everything just goes to chaos by the end.
Yeah, exactly.
In true 70s fashion, like, you can't have a 70s movie and not have a chaotic ending.
Yeah. You get stabbed by masks.
I mean, look at Godfather, chaotic ending. Exorcist, chaotic ending. Mm-hmm. Chinatown, chaotic ending. And it's like, the movie just ends like, Jesus Christ, what a mess.
It was a very satisfying mess.
They were good.
Though.
Yeah, they felt really dramatic. Mm-hmm. The big endings.
It was a very satisfying mess.
It was. The only creepy thing was that dude that started following him. Like, he takes the mask and he goes to stab Snow, and there's that guy in the Hawaiian shirt that grabs a mask off the other lady and starts stabbing him too. And then when he's crawl walking, like, his mask has fallen off and he's trying to get to Phoenix, and he's, like, crawling on the ground, the guy's crawling next to him. He, like, follows him for the whole rest of the movie, and he's just, like, a random extra.
Just mocking
him. Trying to stay in frames, get more screen time.
I got in this, like, bright red Hawaiian shirt, so you can't miss him. So you know it's the same guy every time he shows up. I was like, who is this? I'm like, he's, like, looking over at Winslow while he's crawling. It's really weird.
That's interesting.
What I do like about this movie is not just, like, the campiness and, like, the entertainment value, but I do like how Brian De Palma was able to incorporate a lot of really great commentary and satire for where the music industry was going, because there was a lot of, like, points to essentially where music ended up now, where it's all just overrun by the corporations.
Mm-hmm.
They only have, and they keep all the songwriters, like, cooped up in these little offices and be like, write us a hit. Mm-hmm. And then just kind of have them just slip it out into under the doorway for the producers.
And the contracts,
and the producers get all the credit and all the glory.
The contracts that they're under almost seem abusive in nature. Allow very little creativity. Sort of, you have to make a hit. You're not making music for yourself. You're making music for us.
Yes.
Which is why you saw Prince just pump out so much after he finally got rid of his label. Not that any of it, like,
I mean,
hit
has
the top 100.
Vault, so he would record albums by himself in his own room. He's a multi-instrumentalist, so he would record albums worth of material just on his own.
Like, four, like, CD away. Sets. I saw him. We was putting out, like, four CD sets of music every time he put something out after that.
Even and these haven't been released yet, but even Stevie Wonder, after he died, he revealed that him and Prince like recorded like a few albums together, and they're just in the vault.
It's kind of waiting out there somewhere.
Yeah, we'll just wait for the caretakers of Paisley Park to release them someday, I guess.
We'll be waiting. We'll be waiting.
Yeah, we'll be waiting.
Kind of. Oh, this is that old film that I've been waiting. I hate to say it. I've been waiting on somebody that I can't remember how long he said after his death. Jerry Lewis has a film that he did about a concentration camp clown that he just sealed. Never had it released, and I think it's supposed to be like two decades after his death or something like that. He would be willing to let it be publicly released.
Wow.
It's like what? It was like the Day of the Clown Cried.
He did like a couple of like indie dramas before he died, and like they never got like properly released. They were like always like these just they had a few like indie film festival screenings and then never saw the light of day for distribution.
Hmm. Well, Jerry Lewis was known for one thing specifically, and that was just that outlandish body humor that he did throughout his entire film career.
The bellboy shtick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in his later, which they've resurrected, Professor Fink?
Professor Fink from The Simpsons?
Yes. Yeah. It was essentially the resurrection of... Laven. Oh.
Laven.
Do you think they could have possibly made a sequel from this film?
No, because everybody's dead.
Yeah.
Supposedly, but they come Except up with really weird bullshit maybe reasons.
Maybe Phoenix went on to have like a real career because she's away from all that mess. And maybe they found the secret second half in his apartment and made her like accidentally famous or infamous because she was in the middle of everything. So maybe some more humble producers like picked her up and be like, "We're sorry you had to deal with that, but we really liked your voice and your work on what you did. So why don't you take a stab with us?"
Sequel.
That'd be nice.
Phoenix of the Paradise. But the Phantom
in this, of the Paradise.
The Phantom of this movie is somebody who got caught in the explosion. One of the juicy fruits that got caught in the explosion. His face got mangled and he has to wear a mask.
There you go.
Oh,
see, now there's a sequel.
So there's a whole revenge thing because essentially all these people got caught in the crossfire of what was going on between Swan. But now all the music essentially ends up being 50s doo-wop music.
Well, I'm okay with that.
No.
No?
you got Dion DiMucci, you got the Elegance, you got the Flamingos, Five Satins. You got a lot of good music from back then.
There's a lot you can pull from. She's basically being forced to produce doo-wop music now. At the Paradise. I don't know if you can do a Faustian doo-wop rock opera. I don't know
if that's supposed to be like a personal hell or if it's just a personal
hell. She's stuck in her personal hell because she basically sold her soul to the devil. And while the Phoenix and Winslow may be gone, she still is under contract.
She gave up her voice.
Her contract may not have been voided by Swan's death.
Well, it would depend on if the contract was with Swan or with the devil.
Right.
But they moved away from like that faux doo-wop music, and they moved into that like folky stuff. So maybe she's forced to do like that middle of the road James Taylor type stuff. No offense, Brett.
Middle of the road James Taylor.
Yeah. Dust in the Wind.
Emerson, Lake and Palmer. It's kind of somewhere in the middle. Maybe a little bit of Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan?
Bob Dylan, why not?
I mean, I don't know any Bob Dylan.
You don't know any Bob Dylan? Versions
of Wagon Wheel.
Seriously, you don't know any Bob Dylan?
No.
That's okay.
Bob Dylan. I just can't sing them off the top of my head.
I can pull the name out off the top of my head, but if you ask me to name a song, I'm dead. I'm gone. I can't tell you.
I know the one that's on the Warm Body soundtrack.
He wrote Wagon Wheel, so that's a song that pretty much everybody has covered that he wrote. Hey, Mama, rock me.
Oh, I know that song.
Yeah.
I actually filmed the whole tribute concert of Bob Dylan, so I just can't name
none of those songs stuck out to me.
Wait a minute, you filmed a tribute concert for Bob Dylan, but you can't remember any of the songs? Oh, okay.
Was it Joe Trainer?
I'm just not that big of a Bob Dylan fan. I don't know why.
I'll listen to Bob Dylan if he comes on. I'm not going to turn him off. You know?
Yeah, same. Like,
I wouldn't call myself a super fan of him at all. Just, okay, it's a Dylan song. Okay, I get the voice. I understand the voice. Nope, that's Jacob Dylan. That's Wallflowers, so we're not talking about the same thing.
Bob Dylan had some great albums back in the day. You got Highway 61. You got Blonde on Blonde. Those are pretty good. Freewheeling was really good. Blood on the Tracks.
Okay, so now we're talking to somebody that knows Dylan.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
I went through a Dylan phase in late high school.
Now, color me a little embarrassed for bringing it up now.
I was trying to discover what my music taste was, so because I went from Dylan to like the Smiths and the Clash. It was a very very strange transition.
I'm enjoying the look that Brett is. I think maybe he logged out for a moment there. Brett was given the camera because his eyebrows were arched and he looked a little.
See that? Like, there's like that moment of confusion.
For a moment there, Brett, you kind of looked a little like Jack Nicholson trying to do the Joker. You did. Yeah, your eyebrows were arched in just that way when the camera froze. So.
My camera froze?
Yeah, it froze.
Because my brother.
It's a very concerned look on your face. Kind of, like I said, you looked like you were Jack Nicholson trying to emulate the Joker. All right, any closing thoughts on this movie?
Well, like I
said, glad I now know it exists.
What's up?
Yeah.
Sorry, Rachel. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
I said I'm glad I now know it exists. I didn't before.
I need to rewatch it again. All this refresher makes me want to pick it up and probably watch it tonight, but I'm broke, and the only way to find it is through, you know, running a digital download.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'd rather watch it on, like, physical media, too. There's just something about that. So I may actually get a copy. It just sounds like a movie that is highly rewatchable, and from what I remember of it, I'll definitely rewatch
it. Yeah, I think it might be worth rewatching and, I don't know, listening to the lyrics and see if the lyrics tie more, like, add more to the plot.
Yeah, that's something. That's a new angle to watch it from.
Yeah,
fair enough. I zoned out for a minute there.
And for Sex Pillow.
And for Sex Pillow. Yeah.
And for Sex
Pillow. I realized.
I'm surprised there was no nudity.
Yes, yeah, I was fully prepared for some weird '70s nudity, and we didn't get any.
The closest you got to nudity was
the Sex Pillow scene. It would pop up somehow.
Exactly. I don't.
Yeah. We get out of the living room, and you know.
Let's be honest. You got a little bit of.
And Rachel's like, "Do we need to pause this in case the kids?"
Would you consider shirtless Paul Williams nudity at all?
One of his pairs of pants had a fake penis on it. The one that he wears at the very beginning when he has the snake belt. And there's a silver penis that comes from crop seam and wraps around his leg.
So, which felt like very glam rock.
That's the closest I think we got.
Faux frontal nudity.
Yeah. Isn't Brad we just did a...
Almost have nudity in his films?
Not generally, I don't think.
No, he's usually pretty
But it's like the 70s. Yeah. All bets are off. Like, you don't know.
Especially early 70s.
Yeah, because we just did a whole 70s series, and we watched one where, like, the DVD cover had so many red dots on it because they couldn't find any scenes that didn't have nudity in it. I don't know. It was just so much. And so by the time we got done with our 70s series, I was like, I can't. Like, I just need a cover.
Well, and that one was a European 70s vampire movie.
Yeah, it was a German sex comedy.
Is how they classified it. Yeah.
What film is this?
Hammer films in the 70s.
Did I miss Dracula 1972?
Yeah.
AD.
Yeah.
I would say as
much
as
we did a whole 70s vampire thing.
That's awesome.
As much as I...
Frank Langella's Dracula.
Yeah. Hmm. We started with Frank Langella. We did Nocturna.
It was 1979. There were 8 vampire movies.
Yeah, in 1979, 8 vampire movies were released. So I was like, let's do all 8. So we did Frank Langella, we did Nocturna, which was bizarre because the guy who voices Gollum from the 1970s Hobbit animated movie is in it.
Huh.
And I don't think I'd
and
ever...
his voice sounds the same.
His voice is exactly the same, but he's like the giant, a giant pedophile. Like, he's a pedo in the whole thing, so it's all these just really awful 70s, like, I'm so turned on, cows will have to wear brassieres. Like, all these really weird... but in Gollum's voice, and so that one was hard. And we did Dracula Blows His Cool, which was the one with all the red dots. Anyway, we did Love at First Bite, a whole bunch of them.
I would Love at First Bite kind of stands out there. A little
the
bit.
1979 yeah. Nosferatu.
Yeah, we did that one too.
The Werner Herzog.
Where they released like 10,000 rats in that poor town.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know the scene where there's all the rats? He literally brought rats and just released them into the town. Like, something on the order of like 10,000 rats.
Yep.
Did they pay for the extermination afterwards? Or at least rounding them up?
He tried to turn them all gray. He tried to boil them, dye them gray, and he killed a bunch of them.
Boil them.
Yeah, the like, animal cruelty, like, consultant, whatever, was so disgusted they just left.
Jeez.
These rats are not behaved enough. Yeah, we did the Werner Herzog one. That was interesting. I'm looking forward to the new Nosferatu remake. That's totally off.
I can't wait. But... Oh, yeah, that's going to be really good. Speaking of...
Bill Skarsgård.
The Dario Argento Phantom of the Opera has tons of rats.
And another Italian favorites... Brett, Rats the Night of Terror.
Oh, yes.
I got to make a list here. I got to, like, write a few things down.
Movies that feature an excessive number of rats.
Willard?
Oh, yeah. Willard's a good one.
The original, not the remake.
I didn't mind the Crispin Glover remake. I saw that in the theater. I thought it was okay.
I mean, I like Crispin Glover. I think he needs to do more creepy roles. He really does.
Yeah, same. Like, his shtick, but that was the last thing I remember seeing him in, really.
I think that's the only thing that he does. He either does kind of geeky or ultra creepy. Like, there's no middle ground for him.
Like his role in Friday the 13th as Dead Fuck.
Like, now I'm trying to remember him in that, and I can't.
Really?
Yeah.
He does the famous dance.
Oh, God. I feel like... I feel like a section of my brain is missing.
Friday the 13th, part 4.
Oh,
he asks the girl to dance. He puts a record on, and then he starts doing this completely eccentric, weirdo dance.
And it is vaguely coming back to me and is now forcing my hand to finally break open the box set that I bought. I bought the Shout box set that has all the bells and whistles.
I wanted to grab that. Yeah.
Well, they had it used over at the place that I go to for like $75. So I was like, why the hell not? It's like almost half price.
Yeah.
They were selling it for what, like $139 online?
Wow.
So, I mean, that's sealed and new, and that's all of the films. And Shout always does their films right by making sure there's plenty of bells and whistles and all sorts of goodies along with each film they put out.
That would be one you have to pop in is final chapter.
The whole thing. If I'm gonna go to number 4, I might as well start with number 1 and keep going, you know?
That's true.
Start from
all
the
way up to X.
Just, all right. Halloween's gonna extend till Christmas this year. Just do all of the Friday the 13th movies in a row.
Does that set include just go up to X, or does it include Freddy vs. Jason?
I think that it drops off after X, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think it includes, like, the Freddy vs. Jason, Jason Goes to Hell, any of that stuff.
So it stops at...
I think it's just the number Manhattan.
So it stops at Manhattan?
I believe so. I don't know if it... I'm going to have to check that out, because I'm not sitting next to any of that stuff right now. I'm sitting here. I'm not going to look it up on my phone. I'll wait till later.
Isn't that weird? Like we're on our phone. We're watching each other on our phone, and we're just like, "What is that?" Like, oh wait, shit.
See, this is why I need to have like an extra person that doesn't necessarily talk on the podcast, but like if I bring up something, I'm like, I need to look that up, and they're over here looking it up, so I can continue to talk, so I don't like zone out over
checker.
Here. You know, at the very least, I'm not high this episode, so I was able to talk a little bit.
baby steps.
baby steps.
Gradual improvements each time.
Kaizen.
I basically took a little too much. I greened out on some edibles while I was doing an episode over here with the Strange and Beautiful Book Club podcast. We had them on for Joe versus the Volcano, and the entire time, them and Piper are carrying the conversation because I'm just like, just zoned out.
We did that one time when we were playing D&D. Matt had taken one, and I walked by and handed him another one because I had one in my
hand. She didn't know I had taken one. I was like, okay, I'm going to get prepared.
He's like, I can't remember what just happened. I was like, it's fine. It's okay. You could not hold it
together. I had like a 1 second memory.
This is terrible.
Oh, he just reverted to like Drew Barrymore in 50 First Dates. That guy that I just... what is his best friend that he walks up and he just, every time he talks, like 30 seconds later, his brain resets. He just, don't worry, he won't know who you are. Just wait 30 seconds.
Yeah. That's...
It's like 30-second Larry or something like that. It's like, that's some bad amnesia right there.
What is it? There's the curve of inebriation. There's the point at which you are actually like more creative and then you pass it.
The Ballmer peak.
The Ballmer peak.
After Steve Ballmer from Microsoft. Yeah.
I never
slightly intoxicated, like, removes some anxiety, so you're actually like more productive and creative, but it's really easy to tip over.
I have a fine line. Into very inebriated. Fine line.
Mm-hmm. So there are like online calculators for your Ballmer peak based on your alcohol tolerance, and it'll tell you like how much alcohol you need to consume like every 15 minutes to keep yourself at the peak. There have been studies on it. It started out as a joke, but there have been academic studies on the Ballmer peak.
Person I haven't hired, please help me look that up.
I think I know.
I already know how much alcohol I need, so a lot.
A lot.
There's.
Yeah. I did see you had scotch earlier, or brown liquor of some kind.
I had whiskey. It was like this whiskey that I found in a local shop called like Yellow Corn.
Oh.
It's only like $20 and it knocks you on your ass in like 5 minutes.
I have a weird weird Irish curse. I have high tolerance for consumption of alcohol but low tolerance for inebriation. So it takes very little to get me drunk. I can drink as much as I want and I will not throw up. However, one shot in, give me a couple minutes and I'm already tipsy. Two shots in, call me a cab from anywhere, wherever I am. Call me a cab.
I'm good as long as I don't mix.
If I
keep it steady and stick with one thing, I'll be fine.
I only ever drink whiskey or whiskey mixed into something. That's it.
Yeah, like whiskey with like some tonic or a soda.
Tonic, soda, coffee on occasion.
Yeah,
a little bit of an upper with a little bit of a downer. So
I am actually on 10% battery right now.
We'll end this off by I'm gonna ask you each to give it a rating based off of our newly adopted Spinal Tap scale of 1 through 11. So we're gonna do 1 being the bottom and turning it all the way the fuck up to 11 being the top. Where would you rate this film? We'll start with Brett. Seeing as you haven't watched it in a while, you have to go by memory.
I'd give it a 7.
Okay. Maybe. Okay.
7.5. If I'd watch it again, could go higher, could go lower. But right now, that's where my memory is serving me.
All right.
Like George Costanza's child. 7.
7. Okay.
Yeah, I'd put it at a 7.
6. I don't know. I just feel it being different. Just because some of the songs drag. That's the only parts.
Okay.
There were definitely some. Like, I don't know. I just wanted them to have a catchy, like, if I could sing along, it'd be fine, but a lot of them didn't have a repeating bridge, so there wasn't like a...
They just kind of went on the song and sing along with
it. Yeah, I was in it for the character arc.
That's my only flaw with it, so for me, I'll give it about an 8. I think the movie itself is great, well-written, it's funny, it's smart, and it's well-acted. So I give it a solid 8 out of 10. But I agree 11. With you. I agree with you, Rachel. The music could have been a little bit catchier, but I think they weren't really competing at the time, so Paul was probably just writing whatever.
Okay.
This was before like the big soundtrack boom, so.
So 8 out of 10.
They probably weren't thinking of the longevity of it.
Would you give that a little bit more of a cushion, seeing as we're doing it out of 11 here?
me?
Yeah. We adopted the Spinal Tap scale, so we pushed it to 11. Right?
We pushed it to 11. Yeah. That's right. So I'd probably bump it up to about a 9.
Okay. I would, personally, I'd give it about an 8.5. If we're going to 11, I'd give it about an 8.5. And that's mainly because of the fact that I think this particular film, unlike the Rocky Horror Picture Show, I could watch multiple times and still pick out little bits here and there. Like, I think I've seen enough of the Rocky Horror Picture Show to know that it's all surface. There's not a lot hidden underneath.
There's not a lot of plot, but it's entertaining to watch again because of the music.
Yes.
Yeah, whereas this has a little more depth to the story.
Definitely a lot more.
Like I said, that's where the comparison comes in. Like, whereas Rocky Horror has the advantage of an amazing, timeless soundtrack, this has an advantage of having a tighter wound story.
I've watched this twice in the past week, and I don't feel like, hey, I got to put this on the shelf and wait till Halloween again, because it just feels a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
I can watch this repeatedly. I'm going to be watching it again.
I do really like the ending song, the hell of it, the song that closes the movie.
Yeah, I mean it ties it all together. So
yeah.
It's got just because of the soundtrack alone, it's got a great flow from beginning to end. Though the beginning song doesn't really seem to fit with everything else outside of establishing the Juicy Fruits as just being something. No, I don't want them doing my music. No, I'm good. I don't know what that Romeo and Juliet thing that he did at the end was, but you give it to her, not them.
Well, if you put it in modern times, it's like if you're a serious songwriter and then someone's just like, I'm going to give your music to BTS.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends.
You put it in a modern perspective.
It depends on if they're planning on going a new route altogether. Because you can't just damn a musician or a group of musicians by what they're currently doing. If they're going to take a step in a different direction and give some justice to what you're giving them, fine. But show me what you're going to do first before I say, yeah, sure, here you go, take it all. You know, because I personally, just looking at BTS on the surface, I wouldn't hand them a damn thing. The keys to my car, forget about it, nothing.
Yeah, me neither.
Oh my.
I wouldn't even let them.
I wouldn't give them the gratification of inviting them into the house, let alone giving them anything from the house. I don't like BTS, so I'm good.
I figured. Yeah. I'm getting it.
Yeah.
Feeling mutual.
Does anybody here like BTS? It's just not my music.
I mean, we probably lost some listeners who are big BTS fans.
It's not my music. I'm saying nothing against them. I just don't like them personally. I'm good.
I was into this review until they started shitting on BTS. Click off.
You know, BTS comes on, I'm going to go flip over to Bob Dylan. We're good. All right. Thank you very much, Strange and Beautiful Book Club Podcast, Clockout Films, for joining us here today. Is there anything you want to hawk before we head off for the evening?
Brett?
Anything you're working on you want to talk about?
Oh, well, Galactic Samurai Schoolgirls in Amityville, we just wrapped with. That's going to be part of an anthology film being produced by Don Farmer. The skit was directed by Brian Wilde and written by Newt Wallen. And then you actually see me in it, co-starring alongside Will Keenan from Romeo and Juliet.
That seems like some Charles Band stuff right there.
It kind of is. It was very Charles Band there. And also my good friend Dan Blake stars with me in it.
It has a very Roger Corman style feel to it too.
It sounds it, just by the title alone.
I mean, well, the full movie is an anthology movie going to be called Amityville Aliens.
Okay. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the film that you guys made that we had discussed previously, Slaughter Beach. So if you guys are involved, I definitely want to see it when it comes out, when it's all set for release.
You. You could, there's actually a music video. If you go on Red Cup Films YouTube page, you can watch the music video that one of Brian's actresses she wrote and sung for this with this band called The Falling Hearts. And
yep, our good friend Grendel Clark.
Yep, Grendel.
You're going to have to send me the link for that.
It's actually, it kind of acts a little bit as like a semi-trailer as well, so... And the song's pretty catchy, so we'll definitely send you a link.
For which film?
For Galactic Samurai Schoolgirls and Action Girl.
I wasn't sure if they'd gone back and sort of retroactively made a musical trailer for Slaughter Beach. I didn't know if that was what you're talking about.
But you can watch Slaughter Beach on Tubi for everybody listening out there.
Oh, yes. Definitely. Do it. It's well worth it. It's well worth it.
Tubi.
And
it's nice to be lumped in with all the other B horror movies.
If you watch it,
the endless sea of B horror.
If you watch it and you loved it as much as I did, you go and purchase a copy of it.
Yes, you can go on to Amazon Prime to purchase a copy of it. You can go on to Barnes & Noble. You can go on to the SRS Cinema website to get your Blu-ray copy and a poster.
I own my copy, I own the poster, and I have the t-shirt, so...
which you have to send me a poster so we can all sign it for you and send it back.
Oh, yeah, I'll do that. I got it up on the shelf over here. I've been mm-hmm. looking to frame it, but if I'm going to frame it, I might as well get it signed first, right?
Exactly.
And Matt and Rachel, is there anything you guys want to hawk? Your own shows?
Nope, we're getting ready to finish up Come In 81 Kilo, so that'll be all done. That's our episode-by-episode recap of the seminal Canadian 1990s television show Forever Night. More of a passion project because, like, nobody's heard of Forever Night, but we're almost done with all... We'll be finished with all, like, 78 episodes pretty soon, so
yeah, that's kind of exciting. Yeah, seven more left to air.
Wow. Yeah.
I wouldn't say nobody, but I listened to the first two episodes, and I was like, you know what? I'm ordering the DVDs, and then I'll go back to this. So I went out and ordered. That's ordered all three box sets, and
yeah. Then I just met. I made like a road trip to meet one of the actors who's in it, and she's been in a couple other things. Her name is Catherine Disher. She was the voice of Jean Grey in the original like 1997 X-Men.
Okay.
And she plays in it, and so she was at this con as the voice of Jean Grey, and I rolled up like, oh my god, I love you in Forever Night, and so I like brought my poster for her to sign, and she was like, actually, I've listened to your podcast, and I was like, I'm gonna die, and she was like, I think you're really funny, and she's like, she was really funny, and she was fun to chat with, and she had like a lot of immediate anecdotes about the main male actor, and I was like, I can repeat none of this, but I just thank you so much for this moment. But yeah, so we're almost done with that.
Jean Grey listened to my podcast,
right?
And I think, isn't she coming back? I think all the original actors are reprising their role for the new 97.
Cal Todd's coming back for Wolverine, and
so it's exciting. I mean, that was I was not. We met the main male actor, but it was like this, we met him after a play, and it was like the weirdest experience of my life. I like went into another room, like Matt had to shove me forward and like introduce me, and like, I have to try again, because that was not where, it didn't work. I don't know what happened. I never could not speak before, but all of a sudden I was just like, I just love your show so much.
Yeah, it's just her and her friend both like kind of blacked out.
It's like a little bit of a fan moment, and then she told you that she listened to you, and
I was not anticipating it, and it happened, and then he left, and I was like, "What just happened to me? I have no, like, it's never happened before. I don't know." But yeah, we started Coming 81 Kilo when we started the other podcast, so it's kind of weird to be like, "We're almost done." So,
unlike the other podcast, there's only a limited amount of episodes for Forever Night.
Yeah, you run out. Mm-hmm. You run out. You know. They only made 3 seasons, so.
And we just finished up our Dune deep dive of all the Dune books and movie adaptations and the sci-fi miniseries leading up to Dune Part 2 coming out.
Yeah.
So it's almost finished. You haven't quite finished it yet. You did the deep dive part. Yeah, now you just got to wait for the new stuff to come out.
Yeah, the new Denis, the next one. All right. We'll get to that eventually.
Well,
I hear incredible reviews and reception right now.
Mm-hmm. The first part's good. I enjoyed it, so.
I found the first part to be a little slow, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they broke it where they did. I don't know. Having read and watched all of the adaptations at this point, we watched that one, and that was definitely the most pensive. out of all of them.
Well, hopefully they're intending to hit the ground running with the momentum from the first one, so...
Yeah.
I mean, they have to.
Yeah.
And then just...
they got a lot to cover.
Release one film with them both sort of fused together.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully.
Yeah, just like 6 hours.
Like the extended edition.
Just 6 hours of you sitting there.
It's like everything cut sand. Back in. All right. Well, thank you again, everybody, for coming and hanging out and talking about this film today. And unfortunately, seeing as we haven't figured out a better way to sign off this show, I'm just going to go by saying, drink some water, you thirsty bitches.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
And I'm Matt.
We are the hosts of the Strange and Beautiful Book Club. On the Strange and Beautiful Book Club, Matt and I share our adventures discovering forgotten movies, television shows, and books in the science fiction, horror, and fantasy genre.
Not necessarily good movies, though.
Oh, certainly not. We love a good, bad movie. The quirkier, the funnier, the more campy, the better.
But we talk about some classics, too.
Of course, we can't ignore our favorites like Highlander or the 1990s vampire cop television show, Forever Night, which we are currently covering one episode at a time.
As if I could forget.
Oh, hush. You love every minute of it.
Come join us every week as we discover, discuss, and dissect fantasy, horror, and sci-fi genre classics. New episodes release every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
So remember, sometimes the strangest things are the most beautiful, too.
So be who you are and love what you love. Until next time, friends.
Bye. Bye.
This is Two Chicks Talking Flicks, where we review movies. We try to dig deeper and go more in depth.
For and profound for me.
Yeah, for me, I'm just like, what? We even bring up relevant topics.
I remember from Punky Brewster that you don't go inside the fridge. No, you.
And we're here to have those tough conversations.
Mm-hmm. And she was wearing a white dress, which
was yellow. Huh?
It was yellow.
So if this sounds like the podcast for you, please enjoy new episodes every Tuesday.